Welcome to the Sage and Thyme podcast, the podcast dedicated to exploring the intricacies of mental health and wellness. Your host, Derek Whitman, is a licensed mental health counselor in both New York State and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, who is passionate about guiding you through your journey toward better mental and emotional well-being. In each episode, he and his guest will delve into various aspects of mental health, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you navigate life's challenges. Whether it's discussing anxiety, depression, relationships, or self-care, they are here to provide a safe space for conversations that truly matter. You'll hear interviews with experts, personal stories, and evidence-based techniques as they aim to empower and support you on your path to a healthier mind and relationships. Remember, seeking help is a strength, and your mental health matters. So join Derek and his guest as they embark on this exploration of the mind together. Sit back and relax as they begin this meaningful journey toward a happier and more fulfilling life. Welcome to the show.
Welcome back, listeners. This is the Sage and Thyme podcast, and I'm your host, Derek Whitman. I am without an interview guest today because I've been fighting bronchitis and an ear infection for the better part of 6 weeks. But by the magic of production schedules, I've been mostly able to keep it under wraps. Additionally, I recently also left the group practice I was with for over 6 years, and I have been taking in clients of my own. So today's episode is going to feature some questions pulled from my Facebook business page at Sage and Thyme Mental Health Counseling PLLC. But to get started, I'll present some of my own thoughts in response to common questions asked of therapists. I'll use they-them pronouns in my questions and responses if they pertain to general questions with a therapist whose gender is not specified. I'll use my own pronouns when answering for my own personal and clinical experiences. So the first question I'm going to present today is as follows. I realize we only have 45 to 50 minutes in a therapy session, and I only get to see my therapist once a week, maybe once every other week. What, if anything, do they think about me between sessions? That's really a great question. I think back to my own childhood, and maybe you will too, of thinking about, I wonder what happens to teachers at the end of the school day. I mean, not all of us had teachers in the family or teachers who we were familiar with outside of school. We really didn't know much about them, what they thought, what their families were like, or anything like that. So I imagine it probably feels the same when we think about our own therapists. What are they like? What do they do? While I am unable to speak for other therapist practices, I'll keep this on my personal approach to therapy. At the very minimum, I will at least review my notes from the prior session before we meet. This includes the clinical notes or progress notes that are within your chart. What topics did we address in the prior session, and what's the trajectory of the client's progress on their own treatment goals? Where did we leave off? Was there something that the client mentioned at the end of the session that was safe enough to ask them if that's something we might bring up in the next session? Or was it a crisis? Or even something life-threateningly urgent? In the latter two cases, how did I ensure the client's safety and support throughout the week without calling them? I do keep a phone number option that allows clients to reach me overnight and even on weekends if need be. If there is content from the session that I am less knowledgeable about than I probably need to be in order to partner well with the client, I will take it upon myself to do appropriate research. I might Google. I might otherwise seek articles or books or other content that will educate me in a way that I can better partner with the client. I might even generally consult with other therapists about specific words I might not be familiar with or concepts. However, if I do, I will ensure HIPAA compliance in order to maintain the client confidentiality. I'll let them know that I am not clinically familiar with that experience or event, but I will be looking into it in order to educate myself about it throughout the week. Why would a therapist do this? because the content of what they're processing is far less about the processing itself. Which leads nicely to the next question. When you mention process versus content, it seems like you don't care about my experiences. Surely you aren't saying that. So then what are you saying? You're absolutely right. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is that your experiences mean more to you than to me. And it's not personal either. But this is therapy, so the process of the feelings and emotions matter more. Those are what get in your way of healthier relationships, more productive decision-making, and your ability to attain your goals with more success. During much of the last 20 years, society spent a considerable amount of time trying to understand the importance of validating feelings and saying that, quote, all feelings are valid. And I'm not disagreeing with that statement at all. However, we have, to a large extent, gotten to using the word feel when it's not always the accurate word for the situation. Here's a hypothetical situation demonstrating what I mean. I'm shouting at a soon-to-be former friend in a crowded restaurant without shame. This is the response for my feelings. Feelings, from an article on psychologytoday.com in February of 2022, titled "The Important Difference Between Emotions and Feelings" by psychologist Rachel Allen, are the combination of emotions we experience within the present framework, along with the meanings we've placed on experiences from the past and anxieties and fears of the future. And feelings may not have anything to do with the person or people within the current situation with us. This is where feelings are valid. But when we put feelings first without seeking meaning in history, we often miss out on healthier interpretations of events and experiences unfolding around us. A response, or sometimes a reaction, comes from the feelings, anger, disappointment, discouragement, loneliness, and maybe even others. My shouting at the friend comes from the emotion within my body of tension, of discomfort. The emotion combined with the perception that, quote, this always happens to me, quote, I cannot depend on anyone, quote, nobody makes me a priority, even my best friend, may offer me results that are antithetical to my goal of maintaining a healthy friendship. Notice the dangerous extremes to my thinking demonstrated in the use of the words always, anyone, and nobody. The reality is that even my best friend may not know of my exaggerated and hypothetical struggles with self-esteem and some really anxious attachment I experienced as a child of Generation X, whose parents were among the first generations, Silent Generation and Baby Boomers, who both worked outside the home. This resulted in the stereotypical being left alone for hours at a time after school, which yielded an anxious attachment style. It should be noted that from the observation to the reaction is often a fraction of a second, with the other party having no idea of how they transgressed against me, or more accurately, even that they transgressed against me. They didn't even know the rules, because I never told them. I was never vulnerable enough to have done so. What? Doesn't everyone have the same rules of being on time and knowing what it means to other people when you aren't? The process, back to our discussion, is how we get from point A to point Z, shining the light of the past on the current experience in therapy. And most of that is taking away the self-talk, identifying patterns of thoughts and beliefs that come from actual events we experienced in the past. So a processing session, also known as therapy, might be about reflecting on past events that seem similar or even related, and how we interpreted them and felt back then. This processing helps the client to see that the event isn't really new, but it seems to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, i.e., this always happens to me. This next question came in earlier today. Can therapists really withhold judgment? I thought about this one long and hard because it's a really tough question. Of course, we'd have to define the word judgment, but I'll give it a shot. Judgment might very well mean to assess the client's behavior or decision as being either wrong or right, or bad or good. While it's true that clinicians do assess behaviors and words, we do so with regard to a client's own goals. After all, we as humans all develop some form of values. What motivates us? In my prior example, I discussed the goal of a healthier friendship. I also discussed the behavior of shouting at another person in anger, goal and behavior. What I didn't address was a hypothetical value that I have with regard to relationships. In my example, I value kindness both in the hypothetical and in the real. Kindness has always been a value to me and to many others. So are strong family relationships. Let's say that a client wants to reconnect and rebuild an interpersonal relationship with an estranged family member. We have a value and we have a goal. However, the client, as we say, gets in his or her or their own way and talks gossip with another family member about the estranged individual. The behavior results in what we call cognitive dissonance. This means that the behavior does not align with our goals and our values. Is that something I judge a client for? Absolutely not. The client is probably having a tough enough time, maybe even experiencing a great deal of shame due to the lack of progress on their goals and not understanding why. I should note that it is never in the client's best interest to increase their level of shame, but rather to reduce it, to even, whenever possible, normalize their behavior as well as their feelings. So often it's the shame and the belief that we are different from others that keep us from seeking out assistance for some of our greatest pains in our lives. Even if I were to mention their behavior, it's simply pointing out what they shared with me. I'd help the client to explore the emotions and feelings that existed at the time of the cognitively dissonant behavior. And I would do so from my own therapeutic approach and perspective of what they're processing. Personally, I leverage Rogerian therapy, developed by Carl Rogers, called patient-centered therapy, along with cognitive behavioral therapy, among some other models. Patient-centered therapy states that if a patient or client is the expert of their own experiences, and they're in charge of their own therapeutic process. So we talk about what they want to talk about. And if I have a question or an observation, I ask permission to ask my question or share my observation. My job is simply as a guide toward the client's goals. So I might make the observation, after gaining permission, that sharing gossip about an estranged family member with whom I want to reconcile seems to have moved the client away from their personal healing, even away from their reconciliation with their family member. I'd mention that they're learning a new skill, mindfulness and intentionality, that we get to explore when it comes to the impact of healing. We're going to explore the benefits and dangers of gossip through probably a brainstorming exercise, and we'll even process how the client feels about gossiping, separate entirely from the person they're gossiping about. I make sure not to use the words good or bad, but I've taken to the question of productive versus unproductive when it comes to the client's goals. There's still absolutely no judgment to the client or the behavior. The behavior has worked well so far for the client, and now it's not working because the goal is more important. And the goal must always belong to the client and never the therapist. The goal never belongs to me. This next question is a really difficult one. How do you get over the belief that you're fundamentally broken to the core? First off, to the individual asking the question, sounds like you're really in a rough spot. Unfortunately, as this isn't really therapy, or even close to it, I do wish you well, and I hope that you're able to speak with your social supports as well as hopefully you've got a therapist who is able to assist and at least maybe a primary physician that can help you as well. I'm proud of you for asking that. I really am. Earlier this episode, we discussed ideas such as thoughts, beliefs, feelings, and emotions. The phrasing of your question communicates to me that you know it's an irrational belief. That's huge. That's huge. That tells me that you know where you are, how you're doing, in light of how you want to be doing. Perhaps there's even some hope there. But the word belief is far more weight than the word thought, to me at least. It sounds to me like a significant amount of pain, doubt, and even shame have built up in you over however long a period of time. Secondly, your asking the question also communicates to me that you believe and experience others within your social circle, even a therapist. And these other people do not see you as fundamentally broken to the core. Stick with them. My heart really goes out to you. Social support can be really difficult to not only find, but also rally around a person who's hurting, especially if that pain yields significant other symptoms, often tied to things like self-esteem, including isolating from others, emotional eating, no appetite, trouble sleeping or even oversleeping, and even an inability to manage what we clinicians call standard activities of daily living. These include keeping up with the laundry and dishes, taking care of pets or children. This last set are seen as often some of the last activities of daily living to be kept up with. Because even in severe cases of mood disorders, the individual suffering often pushes themselves in order to tend to the other living creatures, including people in the home. I would generally, if you were my client, explore things like self-esteem, mood, anxiety symptoms, and seek out how your social support, hobbies, and even vocational or career interests are being maintained. Are you going to work? Are you calling out? Are you still enjoying hanging out with friends, engaging in your hobbies, maybe art, music? If hobbies and social support are being avoided and you're not enjoying them, we call that anhedonia, or experiencing a lack of personal pleasure. Anhedonia comes from the ancient Greek word hedeno, from which we get the word hedonism, meaning pleasure. You may be struggling with social challenges as well. From our social support, we can find ourselves experiencing the release of the hormone oxytocin, which comes from seeking and giving support and enhances our connection with others. And then we also have the neurotransmitters dopamine and serotonin. Dopamine is the brain chemical that's activated when we experience pleasure and even pain, and is most associated with rewards. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter generally associated with happiness, and its release affects many of those symptoms I mentioned earlier, particularly with regard to mood disorders. That said, that with the basic possibility of there being a chemical imbalance in the brain, it's really crucial to be seen by your medical provider for consultation as well as blood work, as some of these issues may even be caused or exacerbated by the endocrine system, and it's important to rule out both physiological and substance-induced factors. Now, these substance-induced factors may or may not be, of course, drugs of addiction or alcohol, but they may also be including the side effects from prescribed medications. Please realize, too, that I'm only answering a brief question with no context. Additionally, I'm not assessing anyone for any mental health conditions, nor am I treating anyone outside of my professional practice. That includes any advice, support, direction I give at all on these podcast episodes. This was the Sage in Time podcast. This is Derek Whitman. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.